This is Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. And there's more at allbook-books.com. The last episode of this fascinating, thought-provoking, important book, in my opinion, Jonathan Crary's Scorched Earth, Beyond the Digital Age to a Post-Capitalist World by Verso, will make you aware, more caring and conscious of what's happening with the Earth. And if nothing else, will shake you out of your stupor, techno stupor, if you're in one. I may be repeating a little bit, but it's worth it, I think. About the last 8 pages, we repeatedly are told that machines are becoming more human. An absurd, fatuous claim because it presupposes a neoliberal, corporatist notion of what human is. Prevalence of such inanimate and repetitive exchanges further disables one's aptitude or patience for the frustrations and inconclusiveness of meeting, speaking, and being with others. For the past 15 years, much of the world has become habituated to monetized forms of communicating that isolate a speaker or sender in controllable one-way circuits. At the same time, the internet has fostered a culture of prying and exposure. Everything deemed worth knowing about someone is quickly searchable and retrievable. Whatever might be learned of another over time through earned mutuality and unconcealedness is of no material value or relevance. We are losing the possibility of listening, of facing with forbearance a stranger, someone destitute, someone who offers nothing to our self-interest. We are even less able to understand the difficulties of being present to someone or to accept that dialogue may open up not on connectedness or fellowship, but onto the unknowability of others. Corporate design forms of social media have eliminated the possibility of an ethical relation to otherness and affliction. In numerous ways, we are induced or compelled to follow the routines of digital work and leisure and to align ourselves with their mediocrity and mindlessness. Like Kafka's land surveyor, we convince ourselves that our goals and aspirations can be achieved through a dutiful and numbing conformity with the precepts and regulations of a system we know to be malign. We acquiesce out of passivity or convenience, and over time, we come to have thoughts and gestures that are no longer our own. I heard that from a Dene man recently. What was that? Something about the something about convenience. The affliction of convenience or something like that. Crary continues, we live surrounded by what philosopher A.D. Ophir calls superfluous evils, those many forms of unbearable suffering that could be prevented but that persist by design or neglect. Given the brutalities and injustices plaguing the earth today, to some it may seem of secondary importance to foreground the ethical consequences of these techniques for scanning the gaze, the face, and the voice. Superfluous evils, well, again, I'll mention the Gaza, the genocide in Gaza, because that gets overlooked. Whether you like or dislike Trump, all the news now is about Trump. I follow some of it because I want to see what's going on. But they forget to remind people that not specifically him, but the whole system, the domination system, is under the so-called umbrella and tacitly approving of the ongoing genocide. But let's not talk about that because Melania was wearing quite a intense hat. With a tweaking ability to respond to others, there is no abiding sense of mutual accountability and no motivation to abandon the meager compensations of one's digital insularity. Splintering of a social world is based on the obligatory acting out of busyness, BUSY-NESS, of self-occupation. It's irrelevant what anyone is actually doing, whether looking, working, texting, shopping, surfing, listening, gaming, or whatever. The result is mass acquiescence to an immaterial architecture of separation, sustained by the simulation of self-serving activity and indifference to anything external to that performance. That's quite the verbiage there. Sustained by the simulation of self-serving activity and indifference to anything external to that performance. In such circumstances, there is a nihilistic willingness to let the world lapse. It is an insularity without the restorative benefits of actual solitude. Restorative benefits of actual solitude. It is the pseudo-privatization of public spaces, but without privacy. And again, I find this very insightful because it reminds me of, the verbiage, you know, the iPad, the iPhone, it's very egotistical, but the very fact of having the gadget that you hold in your hand, like when I think of, you know, now I check in my pants pocket, wallet, and keys, but now I'm like hyper checking my cell phone because it's such a, not only does it cost a lot, but it's, you know, it's got all that information and stuff. But, you know, normally walking around, I don't check my wallet and keys except when I'm buying something or, you know, opening a door. But the constant handling of the cell phone, it does, like he says, it makes me think about stuff. It makes me think how that has got people that self, self-occupation, busyness of self-occupation. It's obligatory, you know, in that sense. You gotta be touching that thing, and everybody's like fixated on that. Their hand, it's in their hand, and they're fixated, whether it's work or friends or internet search, you know, nothing against the people in the work and stuff, but the fixation, the focus now is on that rather than on heads up, big crow just flew right by you, or whatever the natural world going on there. The omnipresence of collectively occupied spaces marked by indifference to the proximity of others is inseparable from the scorched earth disaster of the present. It becomes a negative attunement to a world that is no longer shared. So that's, again, an amazing picture of, you know, how people gather in ways nowadays, or gather but they don't gather. The omnipresence of collectively occupied spaces marked by indifference to the proximity of others. And then he extends it to his book thesis is inseparable from the scorched earth disaster of the present. Cumulatively, there is a dissipation of curiosity about otherness or about the wondrous plenitude of non-human life. The individual's subjugation to the market is thus marked by delusions of autonomy and yet grounded in actual powerlessness. The rationalization and full economization of social relations creates a greenhouse in which their imminent opposite, irrationality, always already charged with violence, thrives. It is remarkable that at a moment of unparalleled danger for the future of the planet, for the very survival of human and animal life, that so many people should voluntarily confine themselves in the desiccated digital closets devised by a handful of sociocidal corporations. Pathways to a different world will not be found by internet search engines. Strong verbiage there. I'll repeat that. Desiccated digital closets devised by a handful of sociocidal corporations, pathways to a different world will not be found by internet search engines. Rather, what is needed is exploration and creative receptivity to all the resources and practices developed over the long history of human societies for thousands of years. This speaks directly to indigenous peoples. There are enormous reserves of knowledge and insight from all eras about techniques of subsistence and the fostering of community that need to be recovered and adapted for present needs, especially from cultures in the global South and indigenous peoples. Realistic strategies of resistance also require the invention of new ways of living. There must be a radical rethinking of what our needs are, of rediscovering our desires beyond the flood of shallow cravings that are promoted so unremittingly. So I think this is touching on the big thing here that, you know, a lot of people say, well, we can't go back to living in a cave. But let's apply that wisdom. And let's apply the lived experience of original peoples and other cultures for millennia. And let's see how that jives in today's world and perhaps using some of the technology. And And he goes on to say, present, the main way in which we communicate with others is through what we buy, through the petty symbolic capital we strive to acquire, prompted by envy or the need for esteem. It would be a mistake to underestimate the intractability of individual dependence on the social distinction derived from the branded resources of consumption. But there is also reassuring evidence in times of crisis or emergency that attachments to material possessions and social status can quickly dissipate. For those with children, it means abandoning the desperate expectations these now carry to compare with their peers for individual success, and instead providing them with anticipations of a livable future built and shared in common. So there again, instead of, you know, just keeping up with the Junior Joneses, it's shifting the narrative to, okay, there's this immediate urge, but what about the long range? But these are only the most preliminary tasks, only a necessary preparation for more difficult challenges ahead. Each region or cross-border community will determine its own pathways. But, as many now clearly recognize, the most urgent projects will include the expansion of local food production and distribution, the making available of basic health care and paramedical services, the protection of clean water supplies, and the equitable remaking of existing housing stocks. Both visionary innovation and pragmatic ingenuity will be needed for the reorganization of city neighborhoods, for the reclaiming of derelict spaces, for finding new uses for existing tools and materials, and enlarging a barter economy. Also important will be reconceiving the bonds between human animals, salvaging what remains of biodiversity, and recovering the spirit of festival and arts defined by group participation. Writing in the late 50s with a different array of antagonisms at stake, Jean-Paul Sartre made the claim that scarcity is the basis for all human history. History is born, he wrote, from an imbalance which disrupts all levels of society. The intrinsic violence of organized scarcity produces the unbearable fact of broken reciprocity and of the systematic exploitation of man's humanity for the destruction of the human. At this moment, the mounting scarcity caused by scorched earth capitalism is imperiling the survival of billions of people and other forms of life on our planet. The extreme social disequilibrium, the murderous deprivations, and the ravaging of habitats essential for life are the result of what Sartre called the praxis of other human beings. But he insisted that the response to this violence can be common action by groups and communities that have managed to rebuild, even provisionally, the wounded underpinnings of human relations. Also, isolated individuals can make the discovery that, quote, common action is the sole means of reaching the common objective, end quote. Although global capitalism is run through with irreparable cracks and fissures, it is still held together by individuals clinging to their separateness, their privacy, their freedom from other selves, and their fear of anything communal. The internet complex continues to mass-produce these solitary subjectivities to deter corporate cooperative forms of association, and so dissolve possibilities for reciprocity and collective responsibility. There's one thing, right? Corporation or cooperation? Because as he's showing, the corporations give a false sense of cooperation. I mean, some of it is real, but the overriding control of it is a corporate. The internet complex continues to mass-produce these solitary subjectivities to deter cooperative forms of association and to dissolve possibilities for reciprocity and collective responsibility. The threshold of a post-capitalist world is not far off, a few decades at most. But unless there is an active prefiguration of new communities and formations capable of egalitarian self-governance, shared ownership, and caring for their weakest members, post-capitalism will be a new field of barbarism, regional despotisms, and worse, where scarcity will take on unimaginably savage forms. Sartre saw that emerging insurgencies had a unique capacity to break free of subservience to antisocial apparatuses and to transform passivity and isolation into new forms of solidarity. Revolutionary groups, in responding to a state of emergency, he said, could define their own temporality and determine the speed with which the future comes to it. Now, over half a century later, amid the burning and pillaging of our life world, there is little time left to meet up with a future of new ways of living with Earth and with each other. So there's a stark warning, and I take note, and I suggest people take note. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this 7 parts here for this book. I think of the mad dash where people get trampled to get their big screen, flat screen TV at Walmart, and they line up and they go gaga. I mean, that's some of the energy that is possible if stuff is not working so great. So as he poses, what's needed is forming communities, interacting with people, protecting the water, not being afraid of, you know, communal lifestyles in whatever form, even if you just get along, you know, get to know your neighbors. That's a loose sense of community. Who do you call when you have a problem or need a ride or whatever it is? But building up these forms of interaction that are beyond the technology is, I think, is just good lifestyle in the first place. But in the context of this book, Crary is highlighting it big time. So, Jonathan Crary is Meyer Shapiro Professor of Modern Art and Theory at Columbia University. His publications include Techniques of the Observer, Suspensions of Perception, and 24/7. Big thanks to him for this book, and thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and learned something. So, thanks again, and be well.